So, welcome to the summer. We're in a much more casual mood. And with this in mind, we are opening the vault and releasing an old Patreon episode. So this month we will be doing Alien through Aliens through Alien 3 through Alien Resurrection. And I don't know about you, but when I think of the Nostromo, I think of space and I think of dark and I think of cold and I think of the Xenomorphs. But this is a blockbustery, if there's ever been blockbuster. So I'm looking forward to revisiting these old episodes. And also, if you like this theme, you can thank Davis Burns for making it a little bit sandy and a little bit sunny. Thanks, everyone.
Welcome to Myopia Defender Childhood Special Patreon Edition. This is our first Patreon exclusive episode, and we're doing a series. I guess if you're here, you've already cracked that code. We're doing all Ridley Scott movies. No, we're doing Alien. We're doing Alien from beginning to end. On the main feed coming up in February, we'll be doing everyone's favorite love movie, a romantic movie, Alien versus Predator.
Mm-hmm. The love that dare not speak its name.
Yeah, that's right. But in the meantime, we have the regulars.
Matthew W. Quinn. If you liked Alien, you might want to check out my book, The Thing in the Woods.
Because it takes place in space?
No, but it's got a slimy monsters.
Okay.
There we go.
Hello, this is Daniel, and I've never met a xenomorph, but I'm pretty sure Alf impregnated me.
Oh, there you go.
And of course, not the cat?
No, he eats the cats, but...
Yeah.
I do have to say, he was very tender, surprisingly so.
Do you think that inspired Alf? What alien would eat cats? Hey!
Yeah, the alien at one point is menacing Jonesy.
Jonesy lives, though, so hey.
Hashtag Jonesy
Spoiler
lives.
Spoiler alert. For a movie that's 50, not 50.
It's, 50?
Yeah, it
no,
is.
No, it's 40...
No, it's, 79. It came out 79.
Yeah.
This is...
It's going to be 50 in 2029, but it's 40 now.
I can't do math. So, this is our first Patreon episode, as we mentioned. So, thanks for being Patreon supporters for Us Here Be Tigers and There Be Dragons and Geekly Oddcast and Weekly Oddpast and whatever else.
It means we don't have to send Matt out to sell his body on the street.
I'd much rather extort money to fund the Patreon feed.
Yeah, right. And I will allow Matt to plug this, but there will be no ads on this feed. Mm-hmm. And if you subscribe to our Patreon, our normal episodes are probably going to start having ads on, the normal RSS feed, but you guys will not have to hear us advertise for whatever feminine hygiene products or mattresses or various subscription services.
Or adamandeve.com. I listen to a lot of podcasts where they advertise for them.
What kind of podcasts are you?
A lot of writing ones, surprisingly, like the Project Entertainment Network.
At least one of my favorite podcasts uses Adam and Eve a whole bunch.
Is it Mark Maron?
No, it's The Projection Booth.
Oh, I like The Projection Booth.
Yeah, okay. I actually met the film director, Chris Gore.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I met him at Dragon Con not too long ago. And
we should try to get him on the show.
I'll tell you who we need is Daniel Griffith.
Oh, sure.
He's like the bizarro version of me, basically.
Well, and... we'll see. There's all sorts of stuff we're working on for the new season. As you guys know, we've been teasing it all December and January episodes, and we're going to keep doing so. But for now, I guess we should kind of get into our main topic of discussion. 1979's Alien, a kind of horror masterpiece. And we'll get into this, but something I like about these movies, and I think I've seen only the first four. No, that's not true. I've also seen Prometheus. I haven't seen Covenant.
A lot of people hate Covenant. I thought it was better than Prometheus.
Neither of them were that good, but Prometheus, I think, was better than Covenant.
They were both better than Resurrection.
I was going to say, I started watching the fourth one, and then I said, there's other things I could be doing. There's something on Comedy Central right now.
The guy who directed Amelie and City of Lost Children and Delicatessen turned out and directed Alien Resurrection. I have no idea how that worked.
Sometimes you got to stretch yourself.
Yeah, but not for a multi-hundred... Well, it's the James Bond effect, isn't it? You have someone who does, like... I love Sam Mendes, but when your first movie and like your big movie is
American Beauty.
American Beauty. I almost said American,
yeah, American
Beauty.
Graffiti. That's different.
So you have American Beauty, and then he directs a huge Bond movie, an excellent Bond movie, I think.
He directed a couple things before then that I actually like. Like, I like Jarhead.
Jarhead's good.
Yeah, he directed that, but for a while it was just sort of a cliff for him, and then Bond brought him back.
Yeah. And then I guess in theaters, in theaters now, 1917, the sequel to 1916.
Oh yeah,
the prequel to 1918. This is great for the people at home. So because everyone has seen this movie, let's do the thing. Matt, give us a plot synopsis.
Okay, it's after a very long opening sequence of cameras going through hallways, a bunch of space truckers are awakened from cryogenic slumber. They think they've arrived back on Earth towing what seems like a crap ton of space metal, to find they have been diverted off course to answer what they initially is claimed as a distress call. It turns out it is a distress call, or dun-dun-dun-dun, a warning, mm-hmm. from a crashed alien starship whose pilot is sitting there in the big chair with what looks like something exploded out of his chest thousands of years ago. Meanwhile, one of the intrepid crew, I think it was Kane, decides he's going to go rummaging around and finds a bunch of eggs and shoves his face a little too close to one and gets impregnated through his mouth by a little spider thingy that comes out of his chest at dinner, no less.
So we'll stop you there because this is just the intro. But
well, that's when it starts getting good and it's a little slow.
Boy,
we need to teach you how to write a summary of something.
You know what? For the patrons out there, I'll go ahead and summarize. Seven crew members on a ship get a distress call from an alien spacecraft, and on that alien spacecraft is a nest that contains a whole bunch of eggs. One of those eggs happens to be unhatched, and it latches on to one of the crew. They really don't specify the time frame, but after a couple of days, that crew member dies giving birth to an alien monster, and that alien monster subsequently is loose on their ship and trying to kill them all.
Oh, since we're on the Patreon, I'll give it a shot. It's Jaws in space.
Where no one can hear you scream.
Which was the tagline.
That's the joke.
That was good. That was good.
But, I mean, this is what, 2 years after Jaws?
Four, I think.
So 75
with Jaws, yeah, right?
There you go. Yeah. So this is the birth of the blockbuster. I will say three things about it. First, the cast is incredible. Let's get this. We haven't done Jaws. We will do Jaws maybe one time. We'll eventually get to the fact that it's a series we could do all four of. But Jaws does one thing right. The first one. Only the first one. Which is that the middle of the ocean is terrifying. It's a character as much as anything else. The shark never worked. You know, the horrible stories of Bruce, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Okay. This movie violates that rule once, and it's the terrible last shot where the xenomorph is being blasted into space.
Oh, yeah, when he's dangling outside the escape pod.
And you see the whole thing, and it looks really stupid. It looks atrocious.
It didn't seem that bad to me.
It looks okay because it's an actual... I mean, these days it would be all a CGI effect, which would have looked terrible. I mean, see Alien versus Predator. But, yeah, you could kind of tell it was just a guy
just
wearing
a dude
an alien
in a suit.
Mask.
Just a, it is just... And I forget the guy who did it because he did a lot of things.
He was really tall.
It was...
like 7+ feet tall. Yeah. He was huge.
No, it's funny. It's a good note because... Da, da, da. But he's the dude... What's the guy from Shape of Water?
Doug Jones?
Doug Jones. He's a Doug Jones guy, right? Like, he's never anything other than a dude covered in makeup.
There are production stills out there of him, like, in the suit without the mask.
Yeah.
And it's so bizarre seeing that.
I'm going to butcher this, so I'm going to give it a shot. Balaji Badejo, maybe? Badejo? He's a Nigerian. Mm.
He passed away a while ago, didn't he?
92, at the age of 39.
Ah, jeez.
Tall people don't live long. I'm sorry, guys. I'm sorry. But he's known for Alien, because he was the actor in Alien... And he also appeared as a special thanks on the special collector's edition of Alien. He wasn't even in the second, third, fourth, fifth. Sixth. He was just in Alien. But
he'll live forever in our hearts.
He was good, man. Mm-hmm. I mean, now I give him credit to an extent. He's barely in the movie, which is why the movie works.
Yeah.
Right?
Not, like Matt said, not until the tail end. Do we actually get to see what the alien looks like?
Did you make a tail joke? It has a tail joke. It's tail's
end. I said
end.
Tail end.
The tail end.
Hey. Yeah, and there's a kind of suggestive shot of the tail in the end of the movie.
Well, it wraps around what's her name?
Oh,
around
Helen Horton. Lambert gets raped.
Yeah, Lambert does get kind of raped.
Speaking of which...
It's going up her leg in a kind of creepy way. I never see what exactly happens with it.
Well, and what's his name? well, let's round out this cast. Tom Skerritt, who's
Dallas.
Awesome. Just awesome. I'll get to the best for last, right? But, like, case in point, Harry Dean Stanton is in this as a scumbag, because if he ever played a not scumbag, he might explode.
Right.
Yeah, he's a shifty bastard. That's before he goes murder.
No, you're thinking of someone else. Harry Dean Stanton is Brett. He's one of the dudes.
He's the guy whose head gets crushed by the alien.
Oh, I thought he was Ash.
He was the first one who chases Jonesy. And ends up...
excuse me.
Right.
Right. Who ends up, like, getting, like, dripped on. Like, it's just beautiful. Well, speaking of his buddy Parker, the other engineer, the other grunt.
I can never pronounce his name.
Yaphet Kotto.
Yes.
We've had another Yaphet Kotto movie on here. Live and Let Die.
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
He is awesome. He's the best. And he gets the Captain Kirk, like, torn open shirt at the end of the movie.
You know, that's the great thing about this cast is that they all have these great characters. Nobody's just filler. And when they die, it matters.
And again, case in point, John Hurt. He gets the most iconic scene in the movie. Mm-hmm. He's probably in it for... What? He's in it for about half the movie.
Well, he's the first crew member that wakes up during the opening because they're all cryogenically frozen. And then when they get the distress call, everyone automatically wakes up and he's the first one out. I'm pretty sure in the director's cut, they get out of their sleep tubes in the order they all die. I'm 99% sure.
I believe they do here, too.
I don't remember, though. I only remember Kane getting out.
Well, one of the guys gets out and he kind of sits around for a while while everyone else is waking up.
I will allude to one thing that Matt said, which is that this is boring. Don't watch it. It's boring. This movie sets up ambience, as you'd say. Ambience! Real good. But the mise-en-scène is not only incredible, it's almost exactly 2001.
I think Matt hit on a good point, but let's round out the cast first.
Was John Hurt the big hitter here? Or William Hurt the big hitter here? No, John Hurt.
Tom Skerritt, I think, was the big hitter.
He gets the most lines, I guess. Yeah. John Hurt has been around for a million billion years.
Yeah.
Ian Holm is Ash. Ian Holm, who you know, all of you in TV land, as Bilbo Baggins from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He's the one who's the old dude that Frodo, of course, gets the ring from and appears a lot.
I prefer to think of him as Mr. Kurtzman from Brazil.
Well, he's got a good range. I mean, Ash, you can tell from the beginning, is a shifty bastard. Yep. But Bilbo is like everyone's nice old uncle.
Credit where credit's due. He's excellent in everything. I mean, he plays Skinner in Ratatouille, even. Like, he's one of these dudes who... Is he alive? I hate to say something good about him.
He's alive. He was in a whole bunch of David Cronenberg movies back in the day.
Oh, no shit.
Ooh.
Oh,
yeah.
Was he in Videodrome?
No, he was in Naked Lunch. He was one of the,
yes, he was! Oh, that's awesome. He's also, I think, in Animal Farm. Is that right?
Probably.
And he's also in previous movie, The Fifth Element.
Yes, he is.
He is. And stay tuned episode, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which we can do opposite Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, boy.
that's going to be fun. Is that October?
It should be. I guess you let us know what you want us to do, audience, because those movies are atrocious.
This is just depressing now. I mean, he's. I'm looking at his IMDb, and he's been in 137 things, but he's got nothing lined up right now.
You know why? Because let's look at one of his most recent things. Alien Isolation video game 2014.
Which is a great game.
But that's sitting in a recording booth with a nice warm cup of tea with honey and reading lines. And you know what that is? That's the new bathroom, buddy. You know what? He was born in the 30s, right? The guy's got to be. Let the man enjoy his tea.
All right, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Everyone's got to be old by now.
Well, Sigourney Weaver, still looking good. I will give her this. I mean, she's the last one. We got to talk about her.
No, there's one other person before that, and that's Veronica Cartwright.
And who is she?
She's the other woman on the ship.
Lambert,
yes. No. Okay, the whole thing about her, and I'm pretty sure this is why she was cast, was the birds.
She's the birds. She's Kathy in the birds.
Yeah, the little girl.
She's a little girl. And for those of you who... She also does video games. She voices in Fallout 4... but I think a movie, again, a potential stay tuned that she's in is The Witches of Eastwick.
The John Updike book?
Is that the one with Jack Nicholson?
Yeah, it's the crazy horny movie, which is Eastwood.
Who's in that? It's like Cher, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Jack Nicholson. And who's the other one?
Veronica Cartwright. Susan Sarandon.
Oh, Susan Sarandon. Okay.
And Richard Jenkins is in it as well. It's just a kind of weird horny wish movie
now,
from the mid-80s.
Veronica Cartwright is playing the same character she did in The Birds. It's just somebody who's terrified of everything that's going on. She can really sell that, though.
Yeah, I just, honest God, felt sorry for her, because in this kind of situation, a lot of people will just break, and now, she does that very well.
Yeah.
Quick question. The way I was introduced to this movie was back in the early 2000s when the first Director's Cut was coming out, and it was like 2003 for the 25th anniversary or 20 whatever.
Yeah.
And I remember more scenes with her, and there's just like one scene where after... Ripley won't let the crew back in through the airlock after the facehugger attaches to Kane.
Yeah.
There's a scene later where she goes up after Sigourney Weaver walks into the room and like starts beating her up.
Yeah.
Does anybody else remember that?
I do. Yeah. And I've seen it. I will say, I guess, full disclosure, I found this movie, please.
Was Dallas one of the people she wouldn't let back in?
Yes.
It was Dallas, Kane, and Lambert.
Lambert.
Because it's Dallas dying that really destroys her, so I wonder if maybe there's some subtext there.
Possibly. No,
I would say not. I mean, I think it's more that this is the same crew, except for Ash, which is made a point of, and the two engineers, right? Parker and...
Right.
And so because of that, they're pretty close, and therefore I think this is supposed to be detrimental. I also think, like you said, this is a PTSD thing. She's falling apart because this is not how these things are supposed to go. I imagine being a trucker is generally, it's not boring. I mean, we have trucker listeners. It's just a job. It's the same as anything. Yeah. That's why this is effective.
I think you're right. And that was actually what I was going to jump back into with regards to what Matt said. They're space truckers, which means that this is a boring job for all of them. They're just there to haul minerals.
Well, right. And so you set the coordinates, you go forward, you go back. They're asleep 90% of the time, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not what they're prepared for. Though I totally believe that any trucker I meet is ready to use a flamethrower.
Oh, yeah.
let's dive into this a little bit now that we have the cast together. Tom Skerritt, handsome motherfucker in this movie. I will say, Sudsy, because you guys don't imagine what we look like, I'm tall. I'm the galoot, possibly goon. Daniel is Tom Skerritt in this movie. He's...
Because I grew the beard.
Well, but it's also the squared around face, the warmth in your voice.
Oh, there
and
you go.
And your desire to tell the sex robot to do whatever it wants.
What am I?
You're Ash.
I know you are, but what am I?
Wow.
No.
And what? Because of his high,
Because I'm pretty sure he wants to kill me if I try and destroy the alien life form.
He represents the corporation that wants us all dead.
Well, here's the
thing. I don't know about that. More like grossly indifferent to us being dead. Well, it's not even malicious. They just don't care.
That should be your writer's bio. Grossly indifferent to humanity. Matt Quinn is a writer.
Well, I think that's the big thing about this movie, too, is nobody really looks all that good. Like, nobody's a $20 million movie star. They look like people.
That's why I'm glad, at least to this point, they've never rebooted this. Michael Fassbender is almost too handsome to be in those movies.
Well, he's an android, so that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, but Ian Holm was an android. And I'm not going to say he's a chudman, but he looks like he could be found in a lorry. He's English.
I'm aware.
Well, right, but like that's kind of the point.
Fresh off the streets of Sussex, they are.
I could do a soft English accent. I could do the Hugh Grant, where I'm so adorably befuddled the whole time. So, I mean,
also,
so you're posh, is that it?
All right, so let's just get into this. The first act of this is so 2001, it almost hurts me.
Well, there's dialogue.
A really good soundtrack, though. Even in the beginning, the soundtrack is really good.
I will both agree and disagree, but I also like the use of minimal score. There's a lot of utter silence.
The opening, it works. I mean, towards the end, though, rewatching, I'm like, oh, this sounds like a 1950s haunted house movie. It's so weird.
Utter silence and clicking chains. There's some scenes that almost remind me of Hellraiser.
Yeah, probably.
Fan favorite, I guess. No, I don't disagree with that. And further, the final climax, which we'll get to at this rate in an hour. Jonesy.
Taking an hour to reach a climax, eh? New record.
I learned that from Sting.
Girl.
I learned that from Sting, yeah.
The point is to never have an orgasm. I'm Sting. I used to teach high school students.
I'm losing all my hair.
No shit. Oh, you meant Sting.
Yeah, I meant Sting.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess you only have to have a full head of hair to be on the podcast. Matt's the first one to get cut.
I have some lovely hair, thank you.
You're welcome. I guess that joke was only for Daniel. Anyway, yeah, we have Space Road Truckers. And at this point, they all wake up one by one wearing various skivvies. They have a meal. And
now, I remember back in the day, like I said, you know what? I'm going to interrupt, and I just want to ask. What was the first time everybody watched this movie? Like, when did you watch it? What were the circumstances?
I must have seen it on TV a very, very long time ago. And then I saw it again with a friend of mine who was always having movie nights. And then we went to Chinese Buddha at 2 in the morning.
Okay.
I will say I watched it 2000 and late. Because for me, I was not really a horror dude when I was a kid. I thought everything was kind of spooky. And I didn't like that. I mean, I even remember watching, of all horror things, Independence Day and being butt scared of it. So I never I didn't watch the other one until I was in this one until I was in college, maybe. But I saw the second one a bunch because I was an action movie dude. And so same with Terminator, like the first one, which is effectively a Jason Voorhees movie. It took me a long time to watch. But Terminator 2, which is horror action, dude, I burned that tape through, man. So I probably saw this one in college the first time. Although, tragically for comedy heads like Daniel and I, every scene of it had been essentially ruined. Even the dramatic parts. I mean, like, everything from The Critic to Simpsons to Futurama. Like
Spaceballs.
Yeah.
The cold open is Spaceballs. The never-ending, like, phallic ship scrolling by.
Or the chest burster on when the Spaceballs one sings and dance.
Well, yeah. But even in one of the cold opens of The Critic, they do the alien space helmet scene where Ripley is looking forward and kind of glancing to the side. And then the chest burster comes out and kisses the mask.
Oh, that's from Alien 3.
Oh, and the second one, too. Whatever. But yeah, so that's what it's alluding to.
So I ask because, for me, this was an interesting trip. I saw, I think, Aliens first because I know my mom was my mom was a big fan of it, so that's what we had recorded off cable. And so it's like, all right. Because back in the day, you know, during the R-rated scenes, you'd fast forward through it. So you got like about 10 seconds of a minute scene. But anyway, I didn't see this until like the early 2000s. I think we had rented it from Blockbuster. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. Let's watch it again before we have to drop it off of the Dropbox.
Sure.
So I remember I think it was 2003, 2004, around that time. I was still in high school.
Yeah.
Where they were putting out the director's cut, and that included this massive DVD set. Like, each movie got like a two-disc set.
Ooh. The quadrilogy?
Yeah, that.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that, and this was still when DVDs were novelty, so I was like watching all the behind the scenes, watching both cuts of the movie. I think the version we had from Blockbuster had the deleted scenes separately that were put back into the director's cut. And I remember like getting that and watching this movie with Ridley Scott's commentary. And I mentioned that because during that opening scene when they're all coming out of the pods, he's like talking about, oh, how I just wish everybody was naked. Yeah, I'm just saying. I mean, it was some... there were some real weird things going on there.
That's something.
I mean, that's my exposure to this movie.
There was a sci-fi movie I saw once where that was the premise. You had to get naked to get into the freezing pod.
Oh,
I
think Species? That
was, not Species. It was involving a spaceship.
Demolition Man.
Oh, there you go.
That happens in Demolition
Man.
Well,
the one I'm referring to is this really crappy sci-fi movie involving a space crystal.
Terminator?
No.
Dark
Terminator
Star?
2? No. Terminator 3.
It came out in 1999, I'm pretty sure.
Terminator 3.
That movie, that was obviously in that movie an excuse to get everyone naked.
I don't know. I mean, I remember Ridley Scott talking about it. It was like about vulnerability and like how he wanted to showcase their humanity, which he kind of sort of does in the fact that these are all blue-collar workers.
No, you're true. There is also something not inherently, it's not naive. It's just like, look, we're doing a job. What's throwing us off our job? Right? Like that's the first bit. That's the first interference. Just like, why are we even awake right now?
To me, one of the best scenes, and this is after they get the distress call, so they have to go on the plane to check it out because that's protocol, as Ash, the shifty science officer states, says they have to do. And their pod like gets damaged during the landing.
Yeah.
So Parker and Brett are both talking about the timeline, and I think it was
17 hours.
Yep. Well, Brett says 17 hours, and then Parker's like at least 25 hours, and I'm like, That makes perfect sense if they're working stiffs.
They're working stiffs. They don't care. And again,
they want their shares.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess, Matt, hold your ears. This is another shockingly anti-capitalist movie that we've done incidentally. The corporation literally at one point says, humans don't matter. We can make money off of this.
I don't think it's anti-capitalist so much as anti-corporate.
Corporation. Fair. Anti-corporate. And I mean, the neat thing is, this is Ridley Scott, right? James Cameron did the second one. I'm going to confuse him. But he keeps everything close to his chest. Like, even Ash's role in all this, we don't really know. Other than that the captain says, 2 days or 3 days before the voyage, whatever, right? They switched out the science officer.
Well, they don't even establish that androids exist in this universe until...
They don't.
Yeah.
Until he starts, like, bleeding, like, whipped cream out of his face.
Now,
and they tear his head off and his body still keeps going.
Well, that's how androids work. Now, I have to ask, because this is one thing about the movie that's always confused me. That scene where Ripley confronts Ash, and Ripley's got a bloody nose, and Ash starts sweating or bleeding that white milky fluid. What's the impetus for that?
I think she hits him when he starts. He sounds like at first he's trying to get her on his side before the murdering starts, and then she just smacks him.
Well, it's right after that scene where Ripley accessed the ship's computer, which is named Mother. And I believe
is Jennifer Lawrence involved?
No, I do recall the computer in Alien Resurrection being named Father, but whatever.
Father's dead, asshole. I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. She like throws him up against the panel of the computer room, but that's about it.
Well, I mean,
he could have just nicked himself on something.
They never established that within the framework of the movie, though. So what's going on there exactly?
I think, honestly, it's a Clark. It's an Arthur C. Clarke thing, because even later when he's literally physically attacking her, he seems to be struggling with that, right? Like, as though there's two sets of programming going after each other.
Okay.
Right.
Oh, I mean, when he's shoving the porno mag into her mouth?
Yeah, and he's literally trying to suffocate her. And when he's doing it, he's, like, seizing. He's twitching. Yep. And so the way I interpreted that, but again, you know, a doctor cap to Ridley, because... This is not explained. It's very subtle. I like that it's very subtle. It's all building ambiance because, hey, we're all in this together, but we're not all in this together. I interpreted that as he was struggling with the decision until, I guess, Parker puts whatever he's using as a bat through the back of the guy's skull.
Well, he just knocks his head off, so it's dangling there.
Dangling, and he don't even know it.
So I think we've been dodging around some of the more famous scenes of this movie. Yeah. I mean, I think everybody knows the basic plot. You know, Kane brings Alien onto ship. Alien starts attacking people. Ripley's the only survivor. We should talk about the chestburster scene, because that's probably the most famous thing in this movie.
Well, yeah, let's get us there. They arrive on whatever the planet is. My mic stand just fell apart, so I'm going to play it right.
LV-426, is it?
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to give it to you. I didn't take notes. I was too entangled. You're gonna Google
it. I'm going to look it up. Because I want to be right, because otherwise we're going to get emails.
We will. While you're doing that, I'll fill in the scene. They land on the planet. It's, you know, I mean, it's hazy. It's awful. It's windy. About 2 kilometers away, there's a ship that's giving off a distress beacon. For some reason, Mother is not able to translate it. We find out later that Ridley, with a little bit of... Ripley. I keep wanting to say Ridley Scott.
It could be worse. It could be Ridley the Space Pterodactyl. You ever play Metroid?
I did. Good call.
I mean, Metroid's probably very much influenced by...
This.
By this.
Because it's even a small, strong female protagonist, right? Ripley does start translating the message, and she says, what I can tell, it's a distress signal.
It's a warning.
A warning, in fact. And very good.
I'm getting Event Horizon vibes here. They think it's a distress call, and it's really a warning.
And from there, we cut back to this giant spaceship. And you have a dude who looks like he's in a turret. He's a giant alien man.
Now, that's the space jockey, which they kind of explain who that is in Prometheus, which...
God help you.
Yeah, boy.
Lame.
I mean,
we'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there eventually. I do not like that movie, but...
Here's why this works. It's all mystery. Let it stay a mystery.
Yes.
And what's cool for us as an audience... They're not fazed by the fact that they're alien. We don't know the history. We don't know the science. We don't know anything. They're just, another alien. Cool. Move on. If Han Solo, every time he saw a new Gleep Glob, was like, holy shit, what are you? You lose the momentum of the movie.
Yeah.
Don't care. They then go into this pit of eggs that are apparently in some sort of hibernation?
I think they, this is, I think, something I learned from the commentary back in the day. The eggs, the fluid on the eggs is dripping upward because Ridley Scott, the master technical wizard, just flipped the camera upside down.
Science.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, half of that. I heard a commentary reference he made, too, where he's like, someone asked me why there'd be water just dripping in the engineering room. He goes, I don't know. Thought it was scary. Great. Great. It's a good directing movie. This is one of those ones where luckily the sequel was good, but otherwise applying any logic to this movie makes it terrible.
Yeah, like how does a company know about the alien ship in the first place?
Good question.
And if they did know about it, why do they have to do that whole convoluted get the truckers involved in a mission they're not prepared for rather than do it themselves?
Because all they wanted to do was, I guess, bring it back, right?
Because it's a horror movie, and the less you know, the scarier it is.
But that's it. Because, like, did they put Ian Holmes' ash on there because they knew they were going to come across an alien? If that's the case, why not have them hit the alien on the way to the minerals? Why blow up the minerals? Don't think about this movie. One of my favorite movies is Back to the Future. Don't think about time travel. Don't think about the time travel.
I mean, if we're
the movie falls apart. It falls apart if you think about the time travel, right?
We're going to do the Dr. Evil. Shh.
Just remember, it's okay. He's trying to make out with his mom to save the universe.
If we're going to talk about movies we don't need to think during, I mean, that's what the sequel's for, right?
Or the prequels to Star Wars, or the fourth one of these, or the third one of these.
Excuse you. We'll get there. We will get there.
David Fincher. David Fincher is the king of making the wrong decisions. I'm not going to direct Empire Strikes Back. I'm going to direct Dune.
That was David Lynch.
Ah, hey!
David Lynch was going to do Return of the Jedi, or at least there was talk of it.
Why, hello there. It seems you think I'm the director of Seven. I'm not the director of Seven there, Nicholas.
There were no vaginas in Seven.
Well, there were also no weird backwards-talking dwarfs, and I insisted that the serial killer be a backwards-talking dwarf. But they said no.
How do you remove Kevin Spacey from a movie? Replace him with a backward-talking dwarf.
Also,
Yoda was just sick of people's shit that day.
Have you noticed that Seven is told from beginning to end on a linear timeline? Well, that's just bullshit there, Nicholas. That's utter bullshit.
David Lynch's Fight Club.
Now, the first rule about Fight Club is the daffodils only grow on the red dirt.
Every time you see Helena Bonham Carter, she's putting clothes on in a red room. She's naked, but she's putting the clothes back on, and then it cuts to her corpse, and then it cuts to her back, cuts to her corpse.
Ugh. So it's a red room of pain.
Yeah. And there's a droning sound during the entire scene.
And then at the end, a man in a black suit with a white shirt blows up a building. And then fades back to a cafe where he's eating pie. Kind of a better movie?
It'd be interesting.
In different movie.
Have you ever seen that recut?
What's in the box, George? What's in the box? It's the vulva in the box, George.
Well, you can only open the box with a blue key. And it takes you to a parallel universe that's only accessible through the lodges between two timelines.
This is a whole lot going on.
Oh. And then someone so many Easter eggs. We are making a TV tropes page, so we need to come up with some.
Good Lord.
Someone puts a videotape into the box, and it swallows it.
That's David Cronenberg. That's not
David. Oh, no, another David.
Creepy Davids. That should be a podcast. David Lynch and David Cronenberg.
I'm David.
And I'm David.
And sometimes I go by David, but sometimes I go by Julio.
And then Dave Grohl's just like, and I'm just here, guys.
You paid me, I'm here.
You paid me, I'm here. Good old paycheck Grohl.
Yeah. I forgot
we're going off on some tangents, I guess, because we can't make fun of this movie, because once the chest burster scene happens, it gets real scary and creepy and atmospheric real quick.
All right, can we talk about the chest burster scene?
Sure.
First time you saw it, take me through what your thoughts were.
Honestly, I knew what the scene was. So once you see the alien, jump to his face, I was like, oh, it's coming. Oh, it's coming. The alien autopsy scene is great. When they lock him in that weird chamber to like scan his body, that's great. The fact that you, like Matt was alluding to, Ian Holm as Ash was evil the whole time. And Tom Skerritt is just like, I love Tom Skerritt's character because if you misinterpret this, you think he's evil. Dude, he's just a guy looking for someone else to blame. He's literally just like, man, I just want to get home.
Yeah. Job's done. What am I even doing?
Science officer, just tell me what to do, man. I've been that dude. I know those dudes. And then we have that scene where, oh, it's just gone? Let's have some pasta.
Now, that's the first jump scare, though, is because the facehugger went up into the rafters and died.
And then died. Yep.
And then there's that scene where the corpse falls on Ripley.
Oh, which is something. And then we later find its shed exoskeleton, which makes no sense in this movie.
The molting.
Yeah.
Well, the initial chestburster sheds because it's growing, and then we end up with the xenomorph.
Yeah, and it grows from like 2 feet to like 8 feet without eating anything.
Well, we don't know that.
But well, yeah, what else is there to eat in the ship besides the crew and the cat?
There were 6 cats in the original.
Alf. So it is Alf.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not the first person to point that out there, Matt. I think that was a whole big thing about it, was that this was an artificial creation, which they kind of confirm in the prequels. So take
and
that.
And they confirm it in Alien versus Predator 2?
I do not
The Predators essentially create it to make a better thing to hunt.
They do collect them and dump them in places to infest things to hunt, but I'm not sure if they made them themselves. Because there's also the space jockeys.
It's been a while since I've watched those movies, but I'm almost positive that is confirmed in one of them.
Plus, who knows how this canon works. I mean, well, it's all weird because Bishop's in Alien vs. Predator, but then in Aliens as well, and then we see the real Bishop in Alien 3.
Well, and finally, this clearly was a standalone horror movie.
Yeah.
That's the problem with almost all of these. It's again, luckily Jim Cameron came along and made a really good sequel, because this could have immediately gone to direct to DVD. Because I'm sure this cost money. It's a beautiful movie. It's a great movie. Well, that means the second one should have some budget, but that doesn't mean it would be any good.
Because it made money is why. But I mean, the reason I asked about the chestburster scene is because there's all those legends around it. It's like Linda Blair's head turning around in The Exorcist. That's like what everybody remembers. So
yeah.
You said it was spoiled for you. What do you remember, Matt?
Well, I was a little kid when Alien 3 came out, and I wasn't allowed to see it, but I was allowed to play with the action figures. So I was aware of the lore probably long before I saw any of the movies.
I'm in the same position you were. I had this little red and black crab alien action figure thing that it shot little chestburster missiles. I don't know, but anyway.
Yeah, I had a bunch of those. They're probably still in a closet in my parents' house somewhere.
But what about when you first saw that scene?
I can't remember, because I probably would have known about the mythology and how it worked. I probably saw it on TV in middle school late at night.
There's all these rumors about that scene and how it was executed. Like, there's these people who are like, oh, well, none of the actors except John Hurt knew what was going to happen, which is why everybody looks so scared. And there's no way that worked.
No.
What I've heard since then is they'd obviously read the script. They knew this was the scene where the alien would show up, but they weren't aware of what the blocking was. And especially, they didn't know what the special effects crew was doing. So that scene where John Hurt's convulsing and then there's that little pop in his chest and a little bit of blood spurts out, they thought that would be it, which is why they're all backing away. But then it didn't, which is why they're all leaning in, and that's when the alien comes out, and they're actually using like real animal guts.
Oh yeah.
During that scene, which is why Veronica Cartwright freaks out.
Well, and I will say, like, every scene in this is just, God, it's like someone went shopping at Tim Burton's Whole Foods, right?
Well, like, H.R. Geiger designed all this.
Well, no, but I mean, like, yeah, H.R. Geiger and his weird phallic versus vagina, like, art, but dripping in KY, just like someone backed up a dump truck of KY jelly and just dumped it over everything. When Ash explodes, he's filled with, like, spaghetti and, like, tripe
and
like,
milk
and bubbles. Like, seaweed. It's something, right?
I actually kind of liked how that looks, because he looks human, but then just right underneath, he looks as much like an alien as the aliens do when they're cutting the facehugger up, or he's examining it.
Meanwhile, half the cuts to Alien during the alien autopsy when they like are dissecting the facehugger, it's just like someone's dissecting a chicken, right? Like, it doesn't look monstrous on the inside. They're like, but the blood ate through the floor. It almost cracked the hole. And then the cutting inside of it is just like red meat.
It's shellfish, I think, if I remember
correctly. Whatever. What it is people took chunks of things, they glued them together, and then they, right, you make Monsterman. Meanwhile, Ian Holm, Ash is in the corner having an erection about, like, it's made out of silicone. It's perfect. Ugh, like, I mean, which gets us to, I guess, the sequel with one of the greatest characters ever, the greatest scumbags ever, Paul Reiser.
Oh, boy.
He's up there with the dad from that 70s show in RoboCop.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
I forget the guy's name, but he just it's not even tenting your fingers to think of the implications. No. They know the implications. What if we had an army of these dudes to fight the commies?
The character's name in RoboCop was Bodiger.
Bodiger, that's right.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask about, because this context is lost for everyone.
Oh.
Sigourney Weaver is Ripley.
She sure is, believe it or not.
She was the unknown. The whole shocking thing was that they killed Tom Skerritt. They killed all these established actors, but left her alive.
Yeah.
Did you still get that sense?
Tragically, watching it, kind of, sort of, but no. I mean, obviously, at the moment, she's huge because she's like, I guess, fourth build in my favorite movie. One of my favorite movies, Ghostbusters. So she's been in movies I've seen forever.
Mm.
And again, she's an icon at this point, right?
Well, at this point, yes, but I mean,
because of Alien.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Well, right. I mean, and credit where credit's due, of course, but she's incredible in this movie. That's why we didn't even bother to talk about her in the introduction, because it goes without saying that Sigourney Weaver is spectacular in this.
She's spectacular, but the weird thing is she blends in with everyone else. I mean, she's still involved in the same petty arguments with Parker and Brett.
Over money?
Yeah. That whole, oh, you're guaranteed to get a share. I mean, there's nothing about her that stands out, really.
No, and that makes her a better last girl than half of the Friday the 13th movies we've watched. And I mean, you and I have watched all of them.
Yeah, but a good many of them.
Because, you know, there it's always just like, I'm the smart one. No, you're not. I am, though. And so she survives. It's incredible. Like, she's a competent woman. By the way, of all things, on Vudu, which is how I watch this. I own it on Vudu.
Are you trying for a product placement there?
God, I wish. Not that Walmart would ever need to advertise with anyone. Walmart, you've bought from us. Trust me. They have a weird rating system at the bottom. They rate this one like TV 15 plus or whatever.
Oh, that Common Sense Media bullshit?
That's exactly what it is. And I mentioned it only because they have some great categories for this one. Positive messages, 2 out of 5. Positive role models and representation, 4 out of 5. There's women, there are minorities, they're all equal. Violence, 4 out of 5. I don't know what a 5 out of 5 is. If this is a
Saw.
Yeah, right.
Probably.
Sex, 1 out of 5. That's good. There's not a lot of sex in this.
Well, there's only the one scene with Ripley taking off her clothes, getting into the spacesuit.
And when she comes out of the cryopod, she has just tape over her nipples.
Like I said, Ridley Scott wanted them to be naked.
And I think the word cunt is used once.
I'll take your word for that.
Parker says it to Lambert. He makes a sexual reference to her, whatever.
Oof.
Well, yeah, it's rough.
I thought he was trying to yell at her to stop having a panic attack so he get a shot on the alien.
Well, no, yeah, but he doesn't swear at her then. He swears at her earlier, but he's like, I could eat a peach for hours.
Because these people all vaguely dislike each other.
Drinking and drugs, none. Language, 3 out of 5, fine. Consumerism, not present. That is...
Nope. Oh, good Lord. Did they not watch this movie?
I would say, good. There isn't any consumerism. This is an anti-corporate movie.
It's an anti-corporate movie, but that doesn't mean there's no consumerism, because the whole thing is about...
The only consumerism we can think of is there's the porn magazines and pinups.
That falls under the sex roles and positive messages. It's not very positive. 2 out of 5. What parents need to know, quote, parents need to know that Alien is a classic of horror and sci-fi. Or while not as gory as most horror films, it is too intense for younger viewers.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there you go.
They do that, again, we said about atmosphere and ambiance. They do that very well in the cathedral of metal that is this ship. I mean, why do they feel, why is there so much empty space with chains?
If I ever start a death metal band, Cathedral of Metal is going to be my first album.
I don't know. Space metal's pretty good. Mm. One of the characters smokes, and all of them, in their panic states, use profanity, such as the F word, the S word, and bitch.
I wonder what they'd think of Aliens with its most famous line.
Welcome to Earth. By the way, Harry Dean Stanton hasn't showered since this movie, right?
I believe he has. He's no longer with us, so he's not in a position where he can shower.
By the way, 3 people didn't like this movie. Oh, well, actually, is there anything else you want to talk about?
Yes, actually, there is. That scene in the air ducts when Dallas is going after the alien. because that's Please. One thing in the theatrical version they don't really explain, but that was another big scene that's actually gotten referenced a whole lot. Like, there's that Simpsons episode where Willie's chasing Santa's little helper in the air ducts, right?
Yep.
Now, that's still a jump scare that actually worked, even it's though great. I knew exactly what was going to happen, which yeah. is where they've got a flamethrower, they're trying to smoke the alien out, they are trying to detect it by motion, and Dallas is in there. They insist it's coming towards him. He can't find it, so he jumps down to a lower level, and that's where the alien is. Right. In the theatrical version, that's the end of him.
Right.
They never explain what happens to him. It's really tense just because, like you said earlier, you don't see the alien until it's absolutely necessary. And when you do, you still don't really know what it looks like. So
you do get yeah. a full frontal monster view for about a second.
For like 3 seconds. And this was released back before, you know, home video was a thing. So people couldn't go back and rewind and pause right. it. It was just there.
You know what the Xenomorph looks like because it's 2020. My God. So you know what it looks like. But if you haven't seen this movie, I don't know if you could sketch it, right? It's like this giant banana head that's black and
it's
kind
got
of,
two mouths. It's
metal
got,
teeth.
It's got human hand. Well, it's got a humanoid appearance.
And then a tail. And again,
it's got hands.
Other than that weird last shot, there's not much to it. I mean, they can't track it. They can't figure it out. And despite the fact that whatever it is, it's like micro vibrations in the air. Whatever Ash says, Ripley immediately goes, well, that's bullshit.
Yeah. They test it, though, and it seems to work.
You know, I mean, he picks them off one by one, which is great.
I bring that up because it's one of the all-time great deleted scenes that they put back in the director's cut, where it shows what happens to Dallas and actually what happens to Brett, because he dies, but they actually explain more what's going on. And that's where the whole cocooning thing from Aliens comes in. It was actually supposed to be for this, where Ripley, as she's trying to run to the escape pod, and I think it's meant to be the scene right before she tries to deactivate it, but then it doesn't work.
Right.
The whole thing is that they eventually decide to blow up the ship. There's 3 people left, but then Ripley's trying to go get the escape pod ready, and the other 2 die. And so she does it herself. Anyway, she meets Dallas cocooned, and he's still alive, and that's where the whole Ripley, please kill me bit comes in.
Right. It's effective.
It's terrifying.
I want to rewatch it because I'm kind of curious if things weren't done to it later. There's a few shots in this that I would love to... I'm not going to bother, but I wonder about the prominence of... Because, like, this movie is so visceral. I wonder if some of it wasn't touched up by CGI. I wonder if you can't find a 1977 or 79 cut of those scenes, and I wonder if it was cut because it didn't work, then this movie made $1 billion, and then they fixed it with digital.
For the original version, I doubt it. I think that's what you saw.
You think it's a producer? I mean, it's clearly a producer edit.
Well, I don't think there's any opportunity for there to be CGI in this, or at the very least, if it is, it's some of the most convincing CGI ever.
I mean the opposite. I mean that it's like an old Star Trek episode. In the 90s, they fixed it up to make it look better. I think this movie is a masterpiece. I just wonder if some of the CGI didn't work. Like, we didn't see Jabba in A New Hope either.
Well, this was back in the day where there was no CGI for something like this, so it was all costumes and practical effects, which is, to me, why it works. That scene in the escape pod where Ripley's in there and the alien snuck on there too, and originally its head looks like a pipe that's nearby.
Right.
That was another great jump scare that still got me, because it's like, okay, I know the alien's hand is going to reach out. I know it's in there. It's coming. It's coming. Why isn't it here yet? It's coming. Oh, God, there it is. Oh, yeah. God.
I almost didn't even need the hand because the hand almost doesn't matter. It's just the rest of its snake-like body starts to move.
The fact that you can see its head, too. And
it's great.
Once you realize it's there, you can make it out. It's like, oh, God.
Well, and it's particularly scary because she thinks she's finally done. Like,
right.
She's gone from wearing her heavy, whatever, it's like a denim t-shirt thing, to just her skivvies because she's about to go back into the cryogenic chamber.
She's about to go into the cryo chamber. And,
wearing the tiniest underwear that's ever been.
I wasn't going to mention it, but now that it's here, yes, that was some tiny
crazy.
Underwear.
It's crazy. It makes her look bigger than she is.
I don't know. Sigourney Weaver's a pretty tall woman.
Well, right. But it's like they went to the kids section and bought her that underwear. That's crazy. And then this is where it feels the most like an early 80s horror movie, because she's down to her nothings
and then an alien, and then a monster comes out, right? Like, I'm going to get naked and take a shower, and oh no!
She's still wearing that, like, half tee instead of, like...
Yeah, she's wearing a halter top.
Yeah, which, I mean, compared to what Jason Voorhees would have to deal with, frankly, it's a puritanical approach to horror.
It is. It's great. Because, again, this is going to be not an insult at all, because Jamie Lee Curtis is incredible in the first Halloween, which came out the year before this, because she's never scantily clad. It's everyone else who dies, of course. This is an era of some pretty badass female characters, and the fact that she looks great in this don't matter none. None of these people are sexy. These are just working class schmoes making a hell of a movie.
I mean, at that point in time, if you think that that scene's titillating, then you have just completely ignored the rest of the movie.
No, dude.
It's because she's vulnerable.
This is literally like the end of a long day. You're kicking off your shoes. This is in the Goldbergs, the dad taking off his pants. Again, if you're like mildly into this, you've missed the point entirely. And then shit goes wrong. Right.
What's that song she starts singing?
Little Star or something like
Lucky
that.
Lucky Star.
Lucky Star, you're my Lucky Star.
I've never heard it before.
Oh, dude.
Is that the only foreshadowing that she has a kid? Because in the second movie, it's revealed she had a daughter she left behind on Earth.
In that video game we mentioned, Alien Isolation, you play as that daughter.
Yeah, all that's made up later. That's all fake,
yeah,
man.
That's...
This is not one of those Wikipedia things. Watch the movie. This is great. So I figure, because this is a movie we all like, I looked into Rotten Tomatoes, because why not? There are only 3 negative reviews for this. Time
Those
Magazine,
idiots.
The Chicago Reader, and the New York Times.
Wait, Richard Corliss didn't like this movie?
No, this is 1979. Corliss wasn't around yet.
Oh, okay.
Frank Rich from Time Magazine said, "It is depressing to watch an expensive, crafty movie that never soars beyond its cold desire to score big bucks." No idea what that means.
Good Lord, Mr. Rich. Welcome to 2020.
But my favorite is from Grandpa Dubstep here, Vincent Canby from the New York Times. And if you look at his picture, he's about to yell at me to get off his lawn.
I know who Vincent Canby is.
"These things no longer surprise or tantalize as they once did. In a very short time, science fiction films have developed their own jargon that's now part of a grammar." The fuck is this, old man? This is 2 years after Star Wars, old man. This is the same year as Star Trek, the motion picture.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how hard Kubrick was into all this stuff? He's like, "You can't do me as well as me from the 60s, asshole."
That would be a hell of a thing if it's like what Stanley Kubrick thought of the first Alien movie.
Because Alien and Star Trek, the motion picture, they want to be 2001 very badly.
Well, Star Trek especially. Alien, it's like, we'll borrow that design, but we really don't want it.
Although the first act, man, the slow pandering explanation of space by doing the outside pan of the spaceship.
What else did Vincent Canby not like about this?
It goes on for pages. It's a New York Times review,
oh,
man.
Boy.
It's 1,500 words. The title was Scream, : Alien brings chills from a far-off galaxy, a gothic set in space.
Okay.
Is that a bad thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'll read just the first two sentences here. "A gigantic construction moves serenely through space where, though night never ends, there's always light to see strange objects." This one is like the main set of D.W. Griffith's Intolerance. That's all you need to know. That's the second sentence. Intolerance! Are you kidding me?
The movie that he made because he felt bad about the birth of a nation.
Yes. Yeah, because of course the set of the Nostromo, which is the name of the ship we're on, I'm not sure if we've mentioned that, is still standing on Hollywood Boulevard, and it's a big tourist trap now, and I think L.A. Noire used that as a goddamn level. And fuck you, Vincent Canby.
It's
wrong.
As if Babylon had been cut loose from Earth to set sail through space in its own time.
Well, certainly
what,
big.
What garbage! Whatever. I love what old people say, like, well, because this is literally Golden Age Hollywood ranting at New Hollywood.
Intolerance would have come out in the late teens or early 20s.
1916.
Yeah, so this... Move the 79, so that is like 60 years old. Besides him, who would have seen Intolerance?
Film students.
But that's just it. He is a pretentious classic film guy. Like, and Daniel's right. I've read Vincent Canby before because he is kind of the star reviewer, and he's up there with, what is her name? Pauline Kael at hating all of New Hollywood. Although she is kind of into auteur theory, although I know she, one of her last reviews was Wes Anderson's first movie, and I hated it.
I believe that was a special screening he arranged of Rushmore for her, even though she was like a year away from death.
And I think her line was, you almost show talent or something.
Something like that.
What a bitch. Anyway, we've been talking.
Rest in peace.
Yeah, and I mean, she does some good writing, but if I want America's most contrarian film critic, I'm going to read Chris Cabin.
Or Armin White.
Armin White, yes. Well, if I want to be drunk first, I'll read
not me.
Oh, Armin White.
Well, you're contrarian in saying everything deserves at least 7 stars.
Armin White is the guy...
I gave Hook 5.5.
Armin White is the guy who thinks that Paul Thomas Anderson, the guy who directed Boogie Nights and The Master and Phantom Thread, is a worse filmmaker than Paul W.S. Anderson, the guy who directed Alien vs. Predator.
And Mortal Kombat, previous episode.
Yes.
Okay, let's wrap it up here. I'm going to treat this like a normal episode because I think later ones in this series are going to be ones we don't recommend. Okay? So, Daniel, would you recommend Alien?
Oh, yeah. Ask me again when we do Aliens and see how much of a contrarian I can be.
Matt.
Yeah, definitely. This is really good.
And I guess to wrap it out, I'm not going to disagree with that. Either of you, I will say the only minor tiff I have with Matt is I think the whole thing is good. I think it builds up the horror very good. It shows the modernity of space, and it makes space feel more isolating than ever. The only thing we see other than the spaceship turns out to try to kill them. I think it's excellent. So, if you're listening to this here, thank you for paying us to listen to something. Next month, we'll be doing Aliens, which is Alien 2, but, you know, whatever. And keep listening to our main feed. We're still going to have new stuff on side quests and extra stuff. And thanks for supporting Here Be Tigers, Geekly Oddcast, and Myopia Defender Childhood. And we will be around and... thanks for listening. Tune in next week, every future week. Follow Daniel and I and Matt on Letterboxd. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Facebook. And keep filling out this stuff because we're going to listen to you guys more because you are the ones who are paying for us to do this. So if you have movies for us to do, be a part of that conversation. So stay tuned next week and every future week as we put a piece of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
Myopia Defender Childhood is a product of Blue Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, produced by Nick Hoffman, Daniel Suttis, and Matthew Quinn, and edited by Daniel Suttis. Our theme song is Surf Shimmy by Kevin McLeod from incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons license by Attribution 3.0 license.